Sometimes, watching him, I thought of Dr. Frankenstein's monster, a simulacrum of the human that entirely failed to express any true humanity. His skin was brown leather, and his smile glittered with golden fillings. His was a raucous and not entirely civil presence, but he was immensely rich, and so, of course, he was accepted. But in our downtown community of artists, musicians, and writers, not on the whole popular.
That was Vikas Adam reading Salman Rushdie's The Golden House. Vikas is a classically trained actor with numerous credits in stage, film, and television, in addition to his over 200 audiobooks. He's established himself as one who creates versatile, distinct, and clear voices for characters that he truly embodies. His audiobooks have garnered numerous awards and nominations, including Earphone and Audi Awards. He was also an inaugural inductee to the Audible Narrator Hall of Fame. In addition to recording, acting, and directing, he's a lecturer in the theater department at UCLA. Vikas, welcome to Serving the Story.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you for having me.
I chose The Golden House for the introduction because that's where I first fell in love with your work.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, at one point I actually taught his book, Haroon and the Sea of Stories. So I appreciate the complexity of his work and speaking it aloud, bringing it to life. Does the weight of the work, the lushness of the narrative, affect your approach to the text?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When you've got words like Rushdie, and he is, he paints with his words. He paints with words. He's a chef with his words, and he creates these incredible meals. So in order to really appreciate the meal itself, both as a listener and as a narrator and as a storyteller, I do have to approach it differently, and I do have to approach it a lot more. It does require a lot more of my attention and my energy, but it always ends up being a very, very rewarding experience.
I love the metaphor of the meal, because while prepping, the idea of sort of getting a little bit of the nose or the taste of the ingredients as they're coming together really does feel to me like when prepping is even at its best.
Oh, and I recall with this one, I was in the middle of teaching a very, very, very intense, crazy quarter at UCLA. And so it took a lot of effort and a few sleepless nights to try and get ready for this one and some outside help with this one, so I could just bounce off ideas and make sure that I was heading in the correct direction.
When you're getting a sense of something and you feel the need to check in with somebody else about that, what kinds of things are you looking for from somebody else when you're doing that?
If something specifically didn't raise a question for me, if I was not completely 100% sure of a choice that I may be making, I'll want to be like, what do you think of this? Did you read this the same way that I did? What is it about this particular character or this particular scene in this book that can it justify the choice that I'm considering making? And it's more so just to bounce off some potential ideas, something very, very not dissimilar to what actors will do when they're prepping for roles. I know there's this idea that, you know, we have to come in, we know these characters, but it's like you watch a movie, and I have to remind myself of this all the time. It's like you've got these amazing actors who are doing this incredible work, and I have to remind myself, okay, but they are employing dialect coaches and movement coaches and
right.
They've got all this outside help to help them craft these characters. When I finally remembered that and came to that epiphany, it allowed me to get that permission to really be like, okay, I can talk to people more about this and bounce off my ideas. I don't have to have all the answers.
So you are the unique vessel in the room. And of course, so a character choice through you, even if it's a similar choice to another actor, is going to have a different timbre, a different flavor, a different scent. It's going to be unique because you're the person who's embodying it. I'm imagining that moment of you bouncing one of these ideas off to see what somebody else would do with it. And so it's not about emulation as much as it's to watch their process to see if their process moves like yours does. I mean,
no, it's more so like, yeah, hey, you know, I read this character as this, and I'm considering doing this. Do you think that'll align with what the story is asking for, or do you think am I just coming way out of left field, and is it just going to pull people out of the story? Is it going to work with what the author is telling? Because I'm still always trying to find a way to interpret these characters in a respectful way to the story, but also make it my own so that I can be having fun with them as an actor. So that's usually what I mean by when I'm like, I'm bouncing ideas off of someone. And it's when I've got someone like, for example, like Vasilisa.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like going, okay, how crazy can I, I'm thinking of doing this witchy thing here. I'm thinking of going around. And that's also where my director comes in too. So once again, we've got to remember, based on the audiobook and based on the budget and based on, you know, what is happening with each audiobook, it's going to determine whether I have a director or whether I'm self-directing. And when I'm self-directing, especially, that's when I'm going to be really relying on my outside help to justify a choice if it's coming out of left field. With The Golden House, I had an amazing director in Bruce Mann. And we've worked together on a few books together.
Oh, I love working with Bruce.
I love Bruce. He's such a lovely, lovely man. And we also have a kind of a, I think, was that the first book we worked on? I don't remember. But he really knows how to say, you know what? Nope, you're going too much. Don't worry about it. Versus, you know, oh no, that was great. Oh no, let's go even further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love Bruce's love of language in general, mm-hmm. even before the story.
Yeah.
You know, Bruce has such a wonderful regard, respect for the human voice as an instrument in and of itself, and then language as what it is we are working with as opposed to a series of notes. And so for when I was working with him, it was mostly about keeping an accent true, because my family history was ever so slightly to the east of where the character was set. So I had warned him, uh-huh. it's close enough that I might slip from Hungary into Romania, and that he should keep me honest there. And we were kind of going back and forth on that. And I just love the care that he brings to that. You brought up something, though, and I think a lot of people who will be listening. I made the mistake once of turning down a director when it was offered to me as an option, and I will never make that mistake again. Because of having that first audience in the room with you, uh-huh. while you are working is so invaluable.
Absolutely.
And so your process being different, that you're more likely to reach out if you don't have that director. There's a trust. When you have a director in the room where you can stay completely in the character in the moment versus needing to do all three jobs we do when we're in the room alone, of the acting, the directing, and the engineering, how does that impact, how does that layer on top of the work that you do, needing to be in multiple minds at once?
I think it's well, first of all, you get used to it. I still remember the first time I started self-directing and self-engineering. I mean, well, actually, self-engineering, self-directing, and recording at the same time. Because before, you know, I was used to just getting into the booth with an engineer and self-directing myself. That was super easy. When I had to add in the component of self-engineering, that just took time. And that was baptism by fire. And that was, there were a slew of books that came in, and it was there was a time when I had been contracted to go ahead and do a slew of books, and they were just sending them to me, mm-hmm. and so I had to learn really quickly on the spot, trial and error, lots of hours in the booth. No one saw me, and that's where I was, like, in my own little office. Mm-hmm. outside yeah. of my apartment. And it was just trial and error. It was, that's the least glamorous way I could, it was the most least glamorous thing I could say. It was just blood, sweat, and tears.
Doing a lot of work in New York theater in the 90s before, you know, before all of this, loving the actors who could be there on stage and then stop and then call out to tech and say, am I hitting my light? It doesn't feel like I'm hitting my light.
Yep.
Or whatever's going on. The performers who have that consciousness of the rest of the stage, of the rest of the design, mm-hmm. of the rest of the things that are going on, you know, realizing, having that audience view where they can go, would it make a better shape if I were to cross behind instead of in front of,
mm-hmm.
you know, that sort of perspective brings a different level to things. And I think when we're working completely on our own, it is almost as if we are being asked to, beyond narrating, that we are basically the cinematographer for the, for the in mind movie of the book.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is no doubt about that, which is one of the reasons, based on the book now, especially for most of my books now, I do have an engineer, and I request it because I cannot allow myself. I feel I am stepping out of the book when I am having to be my own engineer. And there are some narrators who actually thrive mm-hmm. when they're doing it all, and they are better at it. And that's the important thing. You've got to know where you fall. It's not a one size fits all kind of circumstance. I know it's knowing where you are best. And there are going to be certain books where I'm like, I don't need a director. I'm perfectly good. And there are some books where I say, no, I want a director. And this has got to be a director whom I trust. And I've built a rapport with over the years, which is what happened with The Goodbye Coast that I just did for Hachette and by Joe Ide. And it was a contemporizing, updating, bringing Philip Marlowe into today. And I knew that I needed to have someone that I trusted with that, because this character is so loved. And I've had you have Scott Brick and Ray Porter who played him, and Eric Jason Martin has done him in a short story, I believe. And I was like, I'm following them up. I need to really make sure I'm focusing on this, and I've got everyone on my corner. So that's when I had Christina Rooney. I requested Christina Rooney for that, and she's one of the most amazing directors. And just someone, your partner, they're holding your hand, and you're both walking down this shaky suspension bridge together mm-hmm. of the story, and you're doing this together as a team.
Right.
It's like a relay race, I guess, in a way.
So the conceit of the audiobook, with us being all of the characters, if it's not a full cast production,
mm-hmm.
and there is so much commitment to character and to character voice and doing all those pieces. In thinking about something that you said early on in this discussion, I'm wondering if that moment of inhabiting the character is different if you are simply one of the characters in the book, where you're trusting that the director and the other actors are going to rein you in,
mm-hmm.
you know, or is that too reckless a way to come, you know, to come at it? I mean, that feels much more stagey to me to go, I'm going to totally commit to this character's life, and it'll be being pushed back upon by the other actors that's going to create the dynamic of the play. Whereas if it's just you
mm-hmm.
and you're moving from character to character,
mm-hmm.
how much of that is going on for you there in that moment? How much are two characters in a scene pushing back in order for you to find that middle versus you needing to make a decision beforehand of where that middle between these two characters lie?
Ooh, there's so much in that one statement you give me, and I'm like all over the place now. So bear with me as I try to pull each of these threads out. So in mentioning when you're working with a full cast and you're playing one character, and I am working with a bunch of actors and a director. In that case, as an actor, I have to be able to read the energy. And yes, I've got to commit to what my vision is, but at the same time, I've got to commit to what the world and the energy that the other actors are also bringing and creating. And that, I think, is so important as an actor, because in general, one of the things I'm teaching my students is I had a student who was so intent on being inspired by the greats of yesteryear, you know, the De Niro's and the angry mm-hmm. The Pacino's and the angry young man. And I was like, you know, darling, you're so busy trying to be angry, you're not paying attention to what everybody else is doing around here, and you're in a completely different play. Mm-hmm. And you're also being unsafe. And one point that some of that did end up coming through where there was a recklessness that was there that he ended up going off script. And me and my co-director, we were just like absolutely in shock as to like, okay, this is a teaching moment. This is why, you know, even though you're completely committed to something, there's still got to be like whatever the percentage is, you know, throw your percentages out. There's still got to be that at least mm-hmm. at the bare minimum, that 1% of you that's aware of mm-hmm. what's going on around you. So that's how it is also, I think, even with audio, you've got to know what, but most of the time we're so lucky to be able to record in the same room or in the same session. Most of the time we are recording completely separately. I mean, that's how you're doing it with animation. You're doing it with even with so many multicast. And so that's when you do have to trust your director. And that's when you have that conversation with them beforehand with, okay, I'm thinking of doing this. Is that too much?
Yeah.
And maybe we do a couple takes where I go as big as I want but I make sure we have some smaller ones. So that's that with that particular thread. When I'm working by myself, this is where I can push, but at the same time, I'm going to start knowing energetically and also vocally, how much can I do it? It's actually an excellent exercise to try and do that, because then I think you start to become aware, okay, maybe it's a bit too much.
Okay. Yeah. So a bit too much how?
I'm thinking back to my angry student. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, it's like, okay, you're getting all this anger out, but then you're doing the response. It's almost like a call and a response. And one of the things I love to do sometimes in this case is actually do a quick recording of myself on my phone mm-hmm. and then listen back to it, because nothing is going to beat listening back to what you've done. By listening, mm-hmm. if you're of the mindset and you're allowing yourself to be objective, and I think that's also an earned trait, a learned trait, you can start to hear, okay, I can be objective enough, you know, this is not going to work. It sounds better in my head, but it doesn't really sound as strong as I think it sounds when I listen back. And once again, it goes back to trial and error. You learn as you're doing it over the years. None of us, when we start something new, are going to be as seasoned as we are if we continue doing it for years. No matter how many years, as an audiobook narrator, I'm different now. No matter how many years of training as an actor I had and how many years of professional work I had as an actor, when I got into audiobooks for the first time, that first audiobook, very, very different than how an audiobook from today would be. And that's just being humble.
So how many of those character choices wind up on the cutting room floor?
When I first started doing it, my prep time was, I didn't have as much. I had to focus on reading the full story. So I actually had to go with, I didn't have many, many character cuts that ended up happening. You know, I tried a couple variations, but then I ended up seeing how sustainability was working. Yeah, in theory, it's great to be able to do this voice, but can I actually sustain that? And on top of that, how will that character translate based on their place in the story? I think of a series I did years ago where a side character whom I chose a very character-y kind of, you know, oh yeah, she's gonna be like this and everything like that. And in another book, she suddenly became the female lead. And the love interest to this character, and I'm like, well, she can't continue speaking like this because her lines are not going to work. And I had to so I tried to keep as many of that qualities as I could, but I did sort of kind of recast her a bit. And
so how do you inhabit that mask but change the reality of the character? You know, you were stuck with the character mask that you had created
yep.
the first time through. And then suddenly the character has much more depth and isn't really being fully reflected with those initial choices, but you still need to figure out how to honor them
yep.
in that other moment.
So I took, so for example, if her original voice was kind of like,
well, hello there, how are you? How are you? And I'm just kind of going to speak like this.
And suddenly she's a female lead. It's like, okay, so maybe,
you know, I will pitch her down, but, you know, I will still try to keep her lips forward, which is what I found that I was doing with her. And so she became a little more husky.
Right.
I just had to breathe and trust that the audience will understand why I made that choice. And then I think about Will and Grace
mm-hmm.
is an example where Megan Mullally, when she started Karen Walker, if you watch the first few episodes, she does not have the distinctive voice that Karen Walker is known for. She actually had a low husky voice. And then episodes in, they discovered this beautiful character voice, and it stayed. And it's one of the best examples of comedy, I think, in television history.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I think to real life examples of choices that have been made, you know, recasting of actors in movies or series, and it's like, okay,
mm-hmm.
the audience has to give you a break to a certain extent. You're trying to honor the story the best that you can. Someone's not going to like it, and you go, I'm sorry. I hope you'll stay on the ride with us, but, you know, this was the best choice at this particular moment.
Right. Again, we are a different instrument. And so if you are taking over a character from somebody else,
mm-hmm.
the expectation that even with a lot of those same things informing your choices, mm-hmm. the sound is going to be unique. A cello is not a viola, no matter how similar the two instruments are.
Absolutely.
Even two cellos will have a different tone, even when played by the same person.
Yeah.
So those things are definitely there. When you were talking about the evolution of that voice,
yes.
And you were talking about, you know, keeping the placement and doing all of that. My question is, were you consciously making the choice to make those changes physically? Or once the character had more weight, were you feeling where the voice was trying to go? And then afterward, you're talking about it in this way of how the voice changed. So were the character choices before the shifts? Or did the shifts affect the character?
That's a real chicken before the egg.
Yeah.
I think it varies. Certain characters, which require a little more physical energy to start getting into the body, because maybe the voice is as a result of making a physical change in my body that it's not used to, and so it takes a little time to get used to that. And then eventually maybe it's easy to start finding the placement of that voice. There are, you know, and anyone who does series will completely be able to speak to that. Especially fantasy or sci-fi series where you've got voices that are of like different species and you go a little crazier with them. I've definitely been able to, of a series I've been working on, find some of these voices a lot quicker than I did when I did the first book, even though they were completely out of my range or they're not something that I would consider to be a regular voice for me. Because we'd been doing it for so long, it became muscle memory.
Right. So not only, so the character choices live in a certain place for you physically.
Yes.
And once they're familiar, it becomes easier to move back and forth in a scene from one character to another, whether it's an alien dialect or dialect in general.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Very, very much so.
I think that actually is a great segue to the other piece that I have queued up here. So when I was looking for things, we had worked on a series of short stories for Cereal Box. And when I was going to go through them to try to find them, the proofer said, oh my God, I know exactly the piece you have to use. And it's a piece that came from Ishq. It's so Usman T. Malik. And it's a sweet potato candy scene. Here's a sample from that short story.
When Hashim went peddling his basket of steamed sweet potato up the alley, yodeling at the top of his voice,
Shakarkandiwala, Shakarkandiwala.
Many a middle-aged lady sighed dreamily and leaned out of her window to watch him go. Come taste my wares, his lilting young man's voice teased. Come take a bite of my sweet potatoes. And they wanted to go. Wanted to take their drawstring velvet purses, abandon the baby carriage in the hall with its shit-stained linen, abolish all principles of a vaguely understood domesticity, and run screaming after the sing-song boy.
Wait! Oh, please, wait! One packet of your shakarkandi, please. Stay a moment, won't you? No, you're charging too much. Leave my alley now, you lying scumbag. But throw me over your shoulders and take me with you.
Completely forgot about that.
Oh, no. Andy did not completely forget about that. That was the one that she said, no, this is the one. We went looking through some of the other ones, and they all the pieces that we kept coming back to were still places where the character choices were wonderful, incredibly specific, and so different from one another that the movement from one lush mask, to go back to a word that I was using in the beginning about the writing in the Golden House, a very lushly painted mask, moving from one to another when they are that detailed, is something very specific and is not something everybody does. And you seem to do it effortlessly, and I know it's not effortlessly behind the scenes, but that's how it comes across when you are in the middle of a story.
Thank you. It's definitely something that I have been doing since I was a kid. I think I was definitely a storyteller that would automatically channel, you know, voices that I would hear. And I still have this memory for these sound bites and sound bites of people's voices and sound bites of snippets of conversation from the past, or things that I've heard that ring in my ear. And actually I brought up an old movie or something like that. I don't even remember what it was, but the other day to my husband, mm-hmm. and I was telling him about it, and I was like, I haven't seen this since I was a kid, but you know what? And I started like quoting this entire, these scenes, and he's looking at me like, you can't remember to put the dishes away when I ask you to, but you can remember that scene. I'm like, I'm sorry. So yeah, I say thank you, Mom and Dad, right. for whatever genetic makeup you gave me to remember that stuff.
My parents' refrain, my mother's refrain, was actually a quote from her mother, and it in Yiddish and the other languages that she would have heard this in. This you remember, but your bruchas, your prayers, you forget.
Exactly. You know. Oh, it's like what do we connect with the most? I definitely do not connect with putting the dishes away. I definitely connect with this movie more.
Right. So when you're consuming media, you know, when you are watching, whether it's a sitcom, whether it's Will and Grace, or whether it's a movie like this, I have friends who will refuse to see an adventure movie mm-hmm. with me sitting next to them in the theater because mm-hmm. I'm too distracting to sit next to. Because, you know,
what do you do?
Well, like back during the first, I think this was Die Hard. He gets shot in the knee with a crossbow bolt.
Uh-huh.
And I grabbed my leg so quickly after it happened that it had appeared to my friend Gary that I was reacting in real time.
Okay.
And he's like, I am never sitting next to you in a movie theater again.
What were you like when you saw Basic Instinct?
you see the problem. The problem is, it's like you're sitting there and you're like, I am viscerally reacting. And these things really are that. And I think that when I'm in the booth working at my best, I am having a visceral reaction to the story.
Yeah. I think I can deal with visceral reactions. What I have a challenge with are talkers in the movie. It's like, no, don't talk to me. Do not talk to me. Do not comment. It's like, physically, you can do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. I say this now without having seen a movie with you, which now I'm very curious as to how I'll respond. But normally, don't say a word.
Yep. I won't say anything. You know, I won't, afterward, I will deconstruct the movie with whoever I'm with and going like, you know, it's like, it was a wonderful film, except, and then you're stuck there talking about that one moment that didn't ring true for you.
My sister hated going to movies with me. And then, and because I was the deconstructor and I was like, I still am. And I'm like, I break everything up and I'm like, oh, this and this and this. And, oh yeah, that didn't work for me this way. And then she went to film school.
Yeah.
And now she understood what I was.
Right. Right. You know, it was Tarantino, not Reservoir Dogs.
Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction. Right. I came out of Pulp Fiction. It was like, yep, it was perfect, except, and it took me all night, but I figured out my except. My except was, I insist that there is a scene on the cutting room floor with the two of them cleaning the blood out of the car that isn't there and isn't technically needed, but it was the character evolution. I wanted to see the two of them talking before the change of mind in the final scene, before everything switches at the end of it. So I wanted to see a little bit more of the process of that evolution. And I thought forever about where do I think that was? And I'm thinking they were cleaning the blood out of the car. Because then they could do something where they weren't looking at each other and they would have had something physical, and that would have facilitated a conversation.
Yeah.
And I can't let go of things. And so when I'm in an audiobook, especially when it's a really heavy subject and, you know, and I will tend to get Holocaust stories and things like that. So when I'm in there and it's a really heavy subject, I'm going with it and I'm in there with it. And then I need to put it down. So at the end of your day.
Yeah.
how do you what do you do in order to leave a particularly heavy story in the booth so that you can have an evening at home with your husband? You know?
I think once again through I think I've always been one of those actors who's been able to let go to a degree and leave the work. It's taken time, it's taken practice, but I've learned to now make it second nature to be able to leave something, even when I'm directing to a degree and creating a new piece. I'll be working with, once again, at UCLA, I run a course during the summer where I'll be creating a devised piece over a few weeks with my students, and my colleague, my work wife, will be doing the same thing. She'll be talking about, oh my gosh, I'm dreaming about stuff. And I'm just like going, really? No. I had a sleepless night, but that's only because I was trying to, like, you know, pass that one level on my one game and stuff like that. And I didn't sleep enough. Mm. But, so it's just, I think it's just happened that as the years, there's been so much going on with me that I, my brain just automatically is like, no, you gotta let go of this, and you're not going to do it. So we're just going to automatically do it for you.
Right. So is the process different than when you're coming back to the session?
Yeah.
When you're putting the character back on for the day's work, is that really when it lives for you?
Yes. And there are going to be certain characters where it's like, okay, it's going to take a little longer for me to get back into it. Mm-hmm. And it'll take me a sec to, like, okay, I need to breathe. I need to find the placement. I need to review, just take a listen again to what I did with the character before. But letting go, I think, comes a lot easier now than it did before. And one of the things that has affected me as an actor, mm-hmm. whenever I've, and this is stepping outside of audiobooks and stuff, is what is happening to my character physically. Because I'm a very, you know, I come from a physical theater background. Mm-hmm. And what I would find is I'd be doing shows which have lots of stage combat, lots of violence and stuff like that. And I would be holding on to that, some of the physical trauma that my characters are doing. And like, what are you doing? What do you mean I'm holding on to this? I'd be talking to my chiropractors and all sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I'm going, I'm not one of those. I've never been one of those, what I consider to be like pretentious actors who's I'm mm-hmm. so in character. I'm not, you know, I never was one of those. And I'm like, well, now you're telling me that I'm holding on to, like, you're holding on to a shadow of the violence that's being done on you. And that was eye-opening to me. And that truly did start affecting how much I would do physical theater-wise and theater-wise as I started getting older. And there are certain books that do creep in and really affect you. And lately, you know what I'm thinking as we're speaking, it's coming to mind. The ones that do have a effect on me lately are the books about LGBTQ plus history. I still recall recording Viral at Penguin Random House with Andrea Kaufman as my director, and we got to a part where the queer publication, they would be talking about all and listing all the people who had died from AIDS, because this was during a time when we didn't have PrEP and we didn't have antiretrovirals and right. getting it was right. a death sentence, and the government wasn't helping us. And finally there was a time where, you know, some strides were happening and medications were coming into play. And there was one day where the queer publication, the headline on the front was "No more deaths announced this week" or something. And I got to the end of the chapter that just, it was a few lines, and I bawled. I'm still, it's like, it affects me a little bit when I think about that, remember that moment, because it was so recent. And it's so easy to keep ourselves separate from the work, to distance ourselves. It's a tricky dance to be a part of, because you can't be so involved that you're losing sight of what you're reading about and you're telling the listener how to feel. But you also can't be so far away from the subject that you're just a journalist who has to be objective and not allow their feelings to bleed in and not allow.
That is the balancing act.
It is a balancing act. It's very much because that also goes back to that young actor that I was speaking about, who was so angry and just had to be angry and show us how angry he was in order to get across what he was doing. That was one example, and some recent examples. The book about Grand Fury that I did that just came out called "It Was Vulgar and It Was Beautiful," and speaking about the artist collective. That worked with ACT UP in order to spread the word, you know, educate the mass population about AIDS. Those lately have been really affecting me more, because, you know, as we get older, we tend to become a lot more aware of what's around us versus just what's happening in our tiny little bubble. It's really humbling to be reading these and to be recording these and, you know, being able to educate people about what came before us. And so I think in a roundabout way, I think it really depends upon the book.
Right.
But for the most part, and where we are in our lives, but for the most part, I'm fortunate that I can separate myself once I step out of my booth, out of my red door, glass door. Mm-hmm. From this booth, and it's almost like a portal, and it's like I step out of there and I'm like, nope, I'm in my other world now, and I step back in and I'm back in the world.
The best stories are themselves roundabout answers. You know, they take you with them, and what I'm hearing here, it's a very bardic approach to the moment. It's an awareness of the audience, but it's not an awareness of the audience as a group to be performed to. It's an awareness of the audience with the effort of drawing the audience into the moment, into the magic in the moment with you.
Yeah. I mean, I've always said that what we're doing as audiobook narrators is that we're doing sonic theater. It's, you know, it's a one-person show. And so we have to be aware of who our audience is and how they're listening and how the size of the theater is. You know, you'd be performing different in a black box versus in a larger scale theater. And that's going to affect your choices. And I'm always continuing to learn. I never feel that, oh, I've got it.
Right.
I can't do that. It's really, that would be really, really egotistical.
Yeah, I think it's the nature of the, not of the art, it's the nature of an artist to always be aspiring to something more, something else. Because I feel like that is the difference between getting to a proficiency is being an artisan. Being able to do something to a quality in a specific way is artisanship. To know that that's the shape you are delivering, but to want to do it with something unique that you bring to the moment is the artistry that we bring to the artisanship of doing this work day in and day out.
Yeah.
And absolutely. It's finding that balance between the two.
How do you do it?
I am nowhere near as elegant as you are with being able to put the story away at the end of the day. It can take me quite some time. In fact, there was a point where I was working at a school for kids who were very self-destructive. And I had a talk with one of the therapists there about how he dealt with things at the end of the day. And he talked about sitting in the car when he would leave for the day, about putting things into the box that he didn't want to necessarily take home with him, but then to do that in reverse at the other end when he would arrive in the morning and before he would walk in, he would open the box and revisit each piece so that way he wasn't walking in without the awareness that he needed to have in order to really be there and be present.
And you know what? You just opened up the door for me as to why it does come easily for me. I think because in another life, I used to be a social worker, and I used to go into the building and go into the office and look at the case files, and then work with the clients. And some really, really challenging, and it did take some fortitude and it took some learning, and then leave. And thank you for bringing that up, because you just completely made, because I was thinking about it, I was going, how am I able to put this stuff away? And this plays a huge role in that, because that's what I had to do.
Right. And we don't find these things unless we speak about them. And then there are all the people who are going, no, I don't want to talk about the process, because if I talk about the process, it won't organically happen. And I'm like,
No, I don't
think that's the way that works.
No, I don't think so either. We are so now oriented, and yes, we've seen instant gratification phrase has been thrown around ad nauseum, but it's so true. It's funny. I'm teaching my students about, when I'm working with them, I'm like, trust the process. It's process versus product. Do not focus on the product. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, everything I'm doing is I'm trying to get them to understand you need to be learning how to do this so that you can, when it comes time to having to create a product quickly, you know how to get there. But right now we are completely forgetting how to explore. And once it goes back to what I said earlier about how it's taken years for me to get to a point where it's shorthand. It's, I don't know if it's a joke or whether it's an anecdote or something, but my husband was telling me how there was a guy who was asked a question, and then he got some lawyer, and he got it done in like 5 minutes, and he gave a bill for like $500, and the client was like, wait a minute, why are you charging me $500 for this? It only took you 5 minutes. And he's like, because this took me 30 years to get to where I am so I could do it in 5 minutes. And that's, and that to me speak that once again, process. It's like that lawyer, I can't believe we're talking about lawyers right now, but you know, that lawyer could not have gotten there
right
without those 30 years. Otherwise, you know, to get that $500, it would have, you and I can both attest to this as we were learning how to engineer and do all of this. I think back to those like sleepless nights where I'm in the booth trying to engineer because I'm so busy worried about the sound outside and wondering, is that bleeding in? Oh my God. And then worrying and spinning within myself, and oh my gosh, an hour has passed and I'm freaking out because I haven't gotten anything recorded because I've been worried about the sound outside, which an engineer who knows what he's doing, or they know what they're doing, my apologies, would immediately be able to say, no, that's fine. And I could have saved an hour.
Set design teachers back in the day would say, if I'm noticing your set, you failed.
Exactly.
You know, after all the work we put into it, it is the part of the art that the audience is not supposed to be paying attention to. It's like when a musician is sitting around practicing scales on and on, over and over, they're doing that so that way when they're in the improvisational moment and something is called for, they're not thinking about the fact that they're going to do an E minor riff and they're going to, you know, they're not thinking that way. They are inside the notes, and we do that kind of work so we don't have to think about those things. And when you've moved your booth, when you've done something like that, and the sounds are new and you're not certain whether those things are bleeding, it's hard to have trust. And then over time, you're settling in.
Absolutely.
And you can be there. And that little voice going, nope, that sound from the elevator never makes it into my recording. I am not going to allow it to pull me out of this moment.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Staying present.
Oh, God. That is I think that's the most exhausting thing. There are literally points where I will say, wait a minute, what did I just read? We need to go back. I don't, it's like, and my engineer will be like, no, it sounded fine. I'm like, can I play it back? Can you play it back? And I'll hear it. I'm like, no, that's terrible. It sounds so unpresent. No, we need to go back. And then, you know.
And I think that's the thing no one ever talks about in any of the things when these things are going out to other people and they're saying, oh, you're reading a book out loud, 10 hours of audio, right? Thinking, no, I'm being present for 10 hours of audio, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. In nonfiction, I am sitting there so in the process of what I am attempting to teach you that I am, that if we were in the same room and you were learning from me, I would know whether or not you were distracted.
Absolutely.
And we would have to stop. Or, you know, yeah, none of this can go by. And I don't think I can speak all day. But if I'm sitting around speaking all day, not in the booth, I'm not as tired because it's not 10 hours of really being present. I don't think people understand that need for the presence and how that can affect what we're trying to bring to the table there.
It's gotten to that point where you begin to start. I have had to learn how to really place my boundaries and say, no, I cannot take the time to do this because I need to be able to go take care of myself. I need to make sure I am at the gym and working out and using that time effectively versus taking that extra job. Because if I don't work out, then I'm not going to have that breath support. I'm not going to be able to be in my body. I am not going to feel energetic. I've had those times where I have not been working out, and I've really noticed how it affects my work. And so people are, you know, I've had some people ask me, well, is it, you're just using your voice? And it's like, no, but I'm using my whole body, my whole instrument. And just because you don't see it doesn't mean it's not important for me to be in the best possible shape that I can be.
Right. I was listening recently to a very short, it's only an hour long, I hesitate to call it an audio book because it was only an hour long. John Cleese on creativity.
Ooh.
And what's very funny about it is when you're listening to it, you totally get that he is not reading the words that are in front of him mostly. Mm-hmm. That this is a lecture he's given a million times and he's got it written out as a very short book, but that he's looking at the chapter headings, then he's pontificating and moving on to the next section. So you totally get that part. But what he talks about a lot in there is that you spend some time doing some focused work, and that is one part of your brain where you can focus and work your way through to an end. But you also need the time of letting your brain relax and to go into different directions. Do you find that when you are working out, when you are walking, running, swimming, whatever, when you're doing those other things, are those the moments that prep material will come together and suddenly say, oh, that's what I need to do with this character or yes. in this scene.
Oh, yes. It's the exact reason how, you know, I'm not getting any work done during the day and I can't remember what I need to do, but then I'm stressing out about it. But then I go to bed and I'm lying there and that's when I suddenly remember everything that didn't happen. It's that, you know, it's that little syndrome and that, but that's very telling as to how, even from an actor's standpoint, if you're working super hard to get something across, or if you're working super hard to get that voice, or you're working super hard to get that character, it's not going to necessarily make it happen. And you've got to find that way to step back and let go. And that's where all these other activities come in.
Right. And I think I've seen people get stuck in the moment when they've done that very focused kind of thinking and they're just not finding it, where they think that they are less than, that they are not capable, and they're not realizing that what they need to do is to back off and let the subconscious kind of let the ingredients stew. To come back to your meal metaphor from the beginning, you've put all the ingredients in, but they haven't had any time to simmer and become one thing.
I mean, this is one of those things where it's like, if I could go back in time and tell my younger self, you know, I mean, it's all encompassed within these few sentences that we've been speaking, because it is about, you know, I think I remember hearing nonstop letting go, letting go, let go, let go. You're thinking too much. Let go, let go. You're working too hard.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that comes from a first generation mentality, where my parents being immigrants and being told my entire life, understandably so, it's like, you got to work hard, you got to work hard, you got to work hard. Whether that was ingrained in me and that just manifested within this work, and not knowing that working hard doesn't necessarily mean one way of working hard. There's other ways to work hard.
Yeah. I can tell you from being second generation, especially when the first generation chose to do things very opposite than what their parents wanted, you get very similar messages from that grandparent generation to what you're talking about, because of course they feel they may not have achieved that with their children, but now is their chance to kind of, I'm very, very familiar with exactly that.
You want that cookie? Okay.
Yeah. We can go off in a whole different thing that way.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, that's beautiful. And I want to thank you for your time on this. And
thank you. I mean,
this has been just a gorgeous discussion. Is there anything that you've got coming up that you would really love for people to know about?
I'm about to start work on a children's book, a classic. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to speak about it, but they're bringing it back.
All right. So people should be following you if they want
following,
to see
following me on that. But it was vulgar and it was beautiful, just released. I am excited about that. I'm excited to do The Dream Runners by Shweta Thakral, because she did Star Daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lovely fantasy, young adult fantasy, but has a very Asian, South Asian root.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be able to see our names and our mythological beings and creatures being taken and expanded upon. So I'm very excited to do that. Follow me on Twitter or on Instagram and maybe TikTok soon. We'll see.
All right.
Yeah. Vikas Adam, and keep up with me that way.
And I will try to make sure that in the show notes on this will be links to all the different pieces that we've spoken about
thank
here so
you.
People can find them.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, in that case, the one I really want to push is Tell Me How to Be, which just came out by Neil Patel. And that is a beautiful book about a mother and a son and the secrets that we each keep. And what was such a delight about this book is it's told in first person point of view from both mom and son. And I was allowed to do both POVs.
Wow.
So that, and it, his writing, we talk about lush and just different than Rushdie. Definitely Rushdie's got his own magical realism and his own style. And but Neil, I'm so excited to see him, his future novels as well, because He's so good. He's so wonderful. So yeah, that's one that I'm especially proud of.
Vikas Adam, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you, Stephen J. Cohen. Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Serving the Story. This week's guest was Vikas Adam, hosted by me, Stephen J. Cohen, with production assistance provided by Adriana Melendez. Serving the Story is produced and distributed by Spoken Realms, found on the web at SpokenRealms.com. Tune in again next time when our guest will be actor, director, scholar, and award-winning narrator, Elizabeth Wiley. Thank you for listening.